Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens, and unfortunately, Kathleen cannot be with us today. And unfortunately, I think she's probably going to really miss talking to our special guest today, because Robert John Landon has written a book called Prehistoric Britain, The Stonehenge Enigma. And before I introduce Robert personally, let me just say that this is one of the most extraordinary books in a very long time which I have happened to come across. It really changes everything we understand about, I think, megaliths as a whole, and Stonehenge in particular. So, but rather than me just going on about it, let me introduce Robert. And Robert, welcome to the show.
Hello, Philip. Well, thank you very much for inviting me on.
Let me tell you that it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. So, first of all, let's start with basics. Basically, you're saying that everything we know about Stonehenge, I think is fair to say, has been too condensed in too little a time span, and that we need to extract everything which we have known about Stonehenge into a far bigger time span so that we really begin to understand the history and purpose of Stonehenge. So, I have basically just one very simple question. What is Stonehenge?
What is Stonehenge? I'll give you a very simple answer. It's a hospital. Stonehenge is much older than the current archaeologists have believe. This is due to the fact that the dating evidence is based on antler picks, which were found in the ditch of Stonehenge. Now, the ditch of Stonehenge has always been perceived to be dry. Therefore, any objects dropped there would have been dropped there at a date where the moat was created. With my hypothesis that directly after the Ice Age that the landscape of Britain was flooded because the groundwater levels rose as 2 miles of ice melted on top of Britain, it would mean that when Stonehenge was created, the ditches were not in fact ditches, they were actually moats. And as watery moats, anything that would have been dropped in there at the time of construction would have floated away or would have been covered with other debris. So what we've got is a very loose date for Stonehenge. We have got actually some really good dating evidence for Stonehenge, which are not, we don't have to rely on loose evidence like these picks, which they find in the ditch. In the car park of Stonehenge in 1960, they expanded the car park due to the fact that they're obviously getting more and more visitors. The archaeologists told them they could expand into the car park because it was perceived that there would be nothing there. According to them, with Stonehenge, it was just talking about the sunrise and the sun god, and the avenue was known about. So they said in the northwest there'd be absolutely nothing because this monument's only to do with the sun, and the northwest it should be empty. So they expanded the car park in 1966, in fact. And lo and behold, they actually found 4 very large pits, and these pits are very, very large. They are marked today, actually, in the car park, and they look like mini roundabouts because they're about a metre wide. And that's very significant because these were very, very large trees, very large trees. At the time, it was quite interesting, they didn't really give much credence to the discovery because they believed they knew the date for Stonehenge, which currently is between 2,500 and 3,000 BC. And when they found the pits, they found charcoal, which can be carbon dated, but they didn't bother carbon dating it due to the fact that they already believed they knew the date of the artifacts found in these giant pit holes. And lo and behold, would you believe, in 1960 they were bagged up and they were placed on a shelf. The archaeologists who found them dated the post holes at the same time, Neolithic, 2,500 to 3,000 BC, same as Stonehenge. And that's where that information would have been lost if it wasn't for a very eagle-eyed student who was doing a PhD in Stonehenge and its foliage. And she found the samples. And as soon as she found the samples, a big question mark came up in her head, because the samples were of pine. They were pine charcoal. And she knew that in the Neolithic period, pine wasn't growing in Stonehenge, or anywhere near that, because pine was one of the first trees that grew directly after the Ice Age. By the time of the Neolithic, it was birch and it was oak. There was no pine trees in that locality. And that was flagged up, and at that point, they actually then sent three of the four samples away, because one was contaminated, and they came back with the most amazing results. And it actually showed that these pit holes in the car park of Stonehenge were actually dated at 8,500 BC, 5,000 years before the Stonehenge site. At that point, the archaeologists had a problem, because the perceived knowledge about Stonehenge was that it was obviously a temple to the sun. It was Neolithic, and they had a problem because they had these pole stones. They're exactly 190 meters away from the center of the site, so they're not a million miles away. And then an ingenious archaeologist come up with the conclusion that they were totem poles. These were ancient totem poles which were put up as a one-off, and that's the reason you had no connection whatsoever with the stone, with Stonehenge at all. And it was just a freak of nature that the dating was so far off the actual date for Stonehenge. So that was left to be placed in history as one of the anomalies which surrounds Stonehenge, except they found another postcode. In fact, actually, the rumour they put round at that point is that because these were found on a shelf for 10 years, the chances are the dates were wrong anyway, because they got contaminated, because no one was actually taken very seriously in the 60s when they found the charcoal. Unfortunately, when they was digging the new visitor centre, they actually found another one, which was on the same alignment as the other three. And this time they brought in a professional company, which is Wessex Archaeology, to actually excavate this ditch. And lo and behold, the date they found on the ditch actually corresponded to the exactly same dates found in the post holes in the car park. So that gives you an idea of the Stonehenge enigma in that sense. You have your archaeological evidence, which can actually contradict some of the expert advice or expert analysis currently. Still, they don't really believe that these post holes are anything to do with Stonehenge. But with my book, The Stonehenge Enigma, what we've tried to show is that there is a direct connection between these post holes and Stonehenge. And it's a very clear connection, because the car park is in the northwest. And this is why one of the theories I have within the book to say it's a hospital. The northwest is quite different, obviously, from the sunset, which is in the northeast. It's actually where the moon would normally set on midwinter's day. It's completely in the opposite direction to where the sun rises, but it's also in the same direction to where the Priscilly Mountains are in Wales. Now, obviously, everybody knows about the blue stones coming from Priscilly. The interesting aspect, if it's connected to the moon, it's connected to death. Moon and death and the Priscilly seem to come hand in hand, and there's a logic there to say, well, these blue stones are to do with death. These blue stones have been brought from the Pasili Mountains. And we've actually got this orientation of Stonehenge. The first part of Fate was known as Phase 1 of Stonehenge. It's just the blue stones with the ditch. Now, as we say, we can almost prove now that after the ice melted, that the sea levels were much higher, the river levels were much higher. And that being the case, you can actually take a boat from Pasili and actually sail it completely to Stonehenge, because at the time, 8,500 BC, if the post poles and the carbon dating of the post poles are correct, Stonehenge would have actually been surrounded by water. It would actually be a peninsula on water on three sides, and the post holes would be a mooring place for the boats from Pasili to bring the blue stones. That being the case, then the original site, Stonehenge, was actually a site for the dead. And one of the interesting factors when we start looking at the holes, and there's quite a few holes in Stonehenge, not just the stone holes with the sarsens, there's three or four rows of different kinds of stones. And if we're looking at the stone rows Q and R, the Q and R stones are in a horseshoe shape, or what I like to call a crescent moon shape, pointing towards the northwest, pointing towards the Pasili Mountains. So, and my hypothesis is that originally Stonehenge was a temple for the dead. The blue stones obviously come in from Pasili by boat. The moat would have been full of water. And one of the interesting facts about blue stones is that the reason they're called blue stones is because they turn blue when they're actually covered with water. Normally they will be a grey colour. When you cover them with water, they turn blue. Now, there's quite a few old tales or myths about how you would use blue stones to cure the sick. And one of but every single one of these myths connect it with water. So the logic is the moat was put round Stonehenge to be act basically almost like a spa. And the blue stones were used as an additive to the water to cure the sick. And we've seen aspects of this in later on in the Neolithic with the Avery Archer, who came from Italy. Now, we could go through the logic of actually how else did someone get from Italy to Stonehenge. The fact is, he did come from Italy. He had flint, which come from the Alps, in his bag. He had a bad leg. And it's perceived now, I think, by quite a few modern archaeologists that Stonehenge is seen as a place of healing. And I think that was because originally, with the moat, these people would come and bathe in the Stonehenge moat. And as I say, it was a hospital for, obviously, sick people. But just like our hospitals there, we go to the hospital, hopefully get cured. But if you don't get cured, unfortunately, and you die, you're put into a mortuary in the basement of the hospital. The same thing would have happened at Stonehenge. If the waters didn't cure your ills, you would have been placed in the open. It's called an excarnation, on probably a blue stone slab in the middle of the site. And basically, the body would be allowed to rot. They have a very strange custom where they don't like animals eating the body, so they would put up a palisade, a wooden fence to stop animals coming. But birds were allowed to eat the flesh. It was seen as, I guess, the birds come from the sky and therefore heaven or whatever the perception of the afterlife would be. So birds could eat actually the flesh. And once the body was completely defleshed, they would take the bones and they would place the bones in what's known as a long barrow. And the long barrows would be on hillsides, normally overlooking waters above Stonehenge. There's quite a few long barrows with cave with compartments within the long bones where they would place the bones. And they have been dated, and it has shown that the long barrels are one of the oldest monuments on the British hillside, basically. And the interesting thing about a long barrow in comparison to a round barrow is that a long barrow is in the shape of a boat. And if anybody sees a schematic of something like West Kennet, which is a very famous long barrow in Wiltshire, they would see it has an entrance at the back where the bones would go, but it's actually shaped like a boat, and it would have had a moat around the mound, and at the time that a moat again would fill with water, so it would have been a mock-up of a boat, basically, and we perceive that as being obviously a way of sending your loved ones to the afterlife via the boat, which we actually see in later on in sort of Egyptian archaeology. So I'm sorry, there's been a long explanation to explain what it was. But at the end of the day, the best way I perceive it is the hospital, really.
Absolutely no problem. I mean, first of all, thank God for a car park for once, because otherwise we would never have known. It's one of the rare occasions where car parks and new visitor centers seem to have actually contributed something to the archaeology of things. And yes, this idea that people jump into a boat and kind of like go across the River Styx and join the afterlife is clearly something. I mean, as you say, all of these islands, which were known in Egyptian mythology, or the islands of the blessed, the islands of the afterlife, clearly there's a component there in the British Isles as well. But
we actually got a very, in Scotland and the Celtic parts, there's still a wonderful practice of actually putting money, pennies, in the eyes of corpses to pay the ferryman to the afterlife. Which is something even practiced today, which obviously has its roots in prehistory.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in parts of Scotland, there were still bull sacrifices happening as far as the 17th century. Certain traditions really die out difficulty. But the most amazing thing, I think, is this, that Stonehenge is thousands of years older than we think it is. And also, and you've touched upon this, but I would like you for you to go into a bit more detail. Basically, where standard historians are saying is that the landscape which we see today, it's pretty much, give or take a few things, the landscape which our ancestors would have seen. They allow for a few more trees, but basically that's about it. But then when you start looking into research like Barry Cunliffe's about how all of these megaliths in Western Europe are, first of all, Atlantic Ocean facing, that is, but also close to the sea, Stonehenge and Avebury are obviously the exceptions. But what you're saying is that the ice age, the ice and the resulting water actually more gradually disappeared than we give it credit for. And then when you look at the archaeological evidence, I mean, the dates which you're using are archaeological dates. They have been carbon, they're carbon dates. They're not just speculation. And when you find out that they get you to the 8th millennia, your opinion, your research has shown that basically those waters disappeared from the British Isles far slower than commonly accepted.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting aspect of that is that a lot of people particularly geologists, it's quite interesting, since the book comes out, there's been quite a bit of debate. A lot of geologists would turn around to me and say, you can't prove there was water there at the time, which is wrong, actually. The river that would have been around Stonehenge is the River Avon, and the Avon actually has what's known as river terraces. And you could actually trace these river terraces in certain parts, not around Stonehenge because it's chalky, but in parts of of Hampshire, you've got these river terraces, which are the mud that's left over from the banks of the river. And it's incredible that there's a thing called T3, which is terrace number 3, which is actually at the height we predict the Avon would have been in Mesolithic times. Now, when you actually go and say, well, okay, we believe it was there in the Mesolithic times, what's your evidence to say it wasn't? They actually use, would you believe, archaeological evidence rather than carbon dating evidence to date these river terraces, which you can't. It's a circular argument. You can't do that because what the people who've actually the archaeologists who found sort of like flint tools and that they've dated that find by the terraces. So it becomes a circular argument where no one's actually got proper carbon dating evidence to prove how high these terraces were and when they were. So it's really quite interesting when you look at the geology of it, that you do have, everybody knows the river was that high, but actually putting the date on that terrace is very questionable. Now, and the other thing we've realized from our research recently is that we have a problem in the UK with groundwater. We're losing groundwater very rapidly. Now, groundwater was always seen to be something that was replenished very quickly. But they've had some very detailed studies now in France, and they've actually bored down to get groundwater and to test it. And there's an isotope where actually, believe it or not, you can actually date water. I think it's isotope 14, where you can actually date water. And they've dated what I call groundwater, the water that's actually in the rocks underneath the ground. And they found that the groundwater there was over 25,000 years old, which is, it startled most geologists because they believed that the water would naturally run its course within perhaps 1,000, 2,000 years. It actually takes 25,000 years plus for groundwater to absorb from the surface all the way down to the sea again. Now, the last ice age was only 10,000 years ago. If we had 2 miles, which you did in Britain, and just about, I think, 20 kilometres from Stonehenge, you had an ice cap which was 2 miles high. Now, anyone in Britain will tell you, if you had 10 inches of rain, it floods. 2 miles of ice is an unbelievable, you know, almost beyond comprehension amount of water. It could do nothing else but flood the environment. The big question is, how long did it take to disappear? I base that on archaeological finds. If you look at things, the most interesting aspects, and one of the oldest monuments in Britain, apart from obviously Stonehenge and Amesbury, is is Longbarrow's. And if you look at the frequency and the height of Longbarrow's in the environment, you will find they're not on top of hills, they're on the side of a hill. They're actually two-thirds the way up a hill. And they've done that very deliberately because that would have been the shoreline of the waters in the Mesolithic period. And that's how they were built. West Kennet has got some huge 15, 16-ton megalithic stones. Now, the only logical way to get that to site would be by a boat. People talk about, and if you go to Stonehenge, you get these wonderful pictures of people dragging stones everywhere, which is marvellous. I mean, it's great for the kids. But it's not serious archaeology, because at the time of construction, Stonehenge was surrounded by a forest. You can't drag stones through a forest. You know, you would have to build the first ever road to get a stone from one place to the next. So they're reinventing not only roads, they're going to probably have to reinvent the wheel to go with the road to get stones to Stonehenge. The logical way you get stones to Stonehenge is by boat. They've done it. We've seen it in the Greeks and the Egyptians. This is the way you get these stones to the monuments. So the chances are of the geologists being right, and the environment you see today is the environment you saw 10,000 years ago. We know it's wrong, because at the end of the day, we know it's covered in a forest. But the interesting aspect is, when we have dug into, as in the car park, into the ancient geology of the landscape, you should find, obviously, trees, tree roots, because if it was a forest, you would have trees cutting into the chalk. What you find is that in the areas where I believe there was water, as in Stonehenge Bottom, which surrounds Stonehenge, there is no trees. And there's a good reason there's no trees, because at the time where there was trees surrounding the upper parts of the hills, that was full of water, and trees don't actually grow in water very well. So that would tell you why the landscape is the way it is. It's a huge debating point about the water in the Mesolithic. But the interesting aspect is that what happens when we look at the archaeology in Stonehenge, there's factors that turn up which suggest water, which have been overlooked, because this perception of being this flat grassy landscape, which it wasn't, is in the mind of archaeologists when they discover things. And one of the biggest one of the persons that dug up most of well, half of Stonehenge was Lieutenant Colonel Hawkley in the 1920s. He done most of the excavation work, and only half of Stonehenge has been excavated, but he's the one that actually done half the work. Now, in the ditches, he found some very strange, curious things, which he couldn't actually come to a conclusion with. The first thing he found was what he called dark matter. There was a line of dark matter in the ditch, which didn't make sense to him, because he saw it as grass and chalk. Now, most people would identify now that dark matter as peat, because it was foliage within water. We know, you know, and that's why it's dark. We all know the colour of that. But the other interesting thing he found at the bottom of the ditch was what he called it a mud layer. I think he's probably talking about clay rather than mud, because mud would disappear over a period of time. And within the clay or mud layer was flints. Now, that's very curious, because we actually see that elsewhere outside Stonehenge, and it's a thing called a dew pond. Now, dew ponds have been constructed from Mesolithic times for cattle to feed on. And what they do, you dig a hole, you line it with mud, and you put, sometimes put straw, but mostly you put flints in it. And the reason you put flints in it, because it becomes a liner, is because the hooves would break the liner and the water would drain out. And then you would quite naturally leave the thing, because the rain would then fall and it turns into a pond. And it's a place where you can actually feed, you know, water your cattle or your sheep or whatever. But they found that liner in the bottom of the Stonehenge ditch. Now, when water is added, in that sense, to the equation, you suddenly start getting archaeology that actually makes sense. Whereas if water's not added to that equation, you've got these anomalies which don't really make sense to man or beast, to be honest.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's just, in retrospect, so obvious, I think, that there had to be a far more important role to water. And I don't want to go in too much detail, but basically your book shows that as the waters receded, the people continue to build monuments, constructions, whereby Stonehenge would remain accessible from the water, and the cursus or the avenue is one such way whereby they made sure that the River Avon when it basically became a river rather than, I would say, an inland sea, was still connected to Stonehenge.
Absolutely. I mean, so the avenue is a real classic case of point. It's one of the great mysteries is that it's... there are two great mysteries to it. I mean, everybody watches Stonehenge and the sunrise. I was there last summer, it's quite interesting. And everybody has to cock their head a little bit for the sun to actually rise over the hillstone. And there's a really good reason for that, because the hillstone's not actually in the middle of the avenue. It's slightly to the right, and it's leaning over, which gives you an indication that perhaps when the avenue was built, it was built at a slightly different date than they perceive again. Because there's a thing called precession, which means the sun would rise in a different place over the next 26,000 years. It rotates forward and backwards by not much. It's about 2 or 3 degrees, but it's enough to change your perspective of where the sun rises over Stonehenge. Now, one of the greatest mysteries to me is that clearly the avenue was built for the sunrise. But when the sun is actually in dead centre of the avenue, the date on that avenue is 4,500 BC. Because the sun precession would move backwards into such an extent that it would be in the centre only at 4,500 BC. But because that date doesn't coincide with the pick finds in the pits, is completely ignored, and I find it quite amazing. But you're quite right that the avenue is a fascinating addition to Stonehenge, because it marks the change from Stonehenge from a temple for the dying and the moon to a temple for the living. And this is when the big Sarsen stones came, and obviously a culture change in that respect. And they built, at that time, that was the Neolithic age, 4,500 BC, so we're talking about 4,000 years later. The river would have shrunk, and Stonehenge Bottom River would have got much smaller. And the amazing thing about the avenue, if we're correct in our hypothesis, is that the river would have finished what's known at the elbow rather than at the car park. So what they seem to have done is built this processional causeway from Stonehenge in the northeast side all the way down to what's known as the elbow to meet the new mooring area, really, for the River Avon. And that is shown very clearly by the ditches they've dug on each side of the avenue, because on one side it's deeper than the other. Now, to me, they're quite good engineers. You know, if you can put Stonehenge up, which I personally couldn't, I respect their engineering abilities. And if they wanted to make the ditches on either side of the avenue even, I'm sure they would have done. But they didn't. They made one shallower than the other. And the reason is, on one side of the avenue, you would have the river. On the other side, you would not. And to even up the water, you would have to dig on one side deeper than the other. It's a little bit like digging for a well. One side you would have to dig deeper to get to the waterline than the other. And that's why they're slightly lopsided with the ditches. But both sides of the avenue would have been a watery ditch, and it would have looked like a magnificent procession way for people to bring their boats and then walk down the avenue towards the Stonehenge.
And people just didn't come to Stonehenge. One of my pet peeves is that quite often Stonehenge is seen as a standalone item, as if nobody else was aware of Avebury, which is roughly, I think, 20 miles north. Now, from the title of your book, Prehistoric Britain, The Stonehenge Enigma, you might think that Robert has done exactly the same thing and has focused solely on Stonehenge, but absolutely that's not the case. You've looked at Stonehenge, you've looked at the surrounding monuments, you've already mentioned West Kennet, Longbarrow. You've looked definitely at Avebury, and you've also found that basically the area around Stonehenge had pointers to help people coming in, specifically on boats, to find it. And then from there to also move to Avebury, or from Avebury to move to Stonehenge. So you've explained what Stonehenge is, what its purpose was. Where do you think Avebury fits in, and what do you think that purpose was?
Okay, well, quite interesting. If you look at the Stonehenge monument, there's three very distinctive markers at Stonehenge. One is obviously the hillstone, and when you look at the archaeology, it was actually surrounded with its own moat. And there's the north station and the south station stones, both with their own moats. Now, the north station moat points quite rightly to say to Avebury. Now, Avebury is a fascinating area, and I've only recently come back then with more data. It seems that Avebury began at this, obviously, I think slightly probably before Stonehenge. And there's a place in Avebury called Windmill Hill. Now, Windmill Hill is fascinating because it's got they call it a causeway camp, which I think is it's a camp with lots of rings on it, basically. Now, one of the interesting aspects is if Stonehenge is as old as we believe, the dates match Plato's Atlantis. Now, Atlantis is interesting because it has these concentric circles, which obviously is a landmark. It's something. It's a technique where the people from Atlantis would use elsewhere outside Atlantis if they were going to mark certain sites or certain landmarks or islands. Now, one of the interesting aspects with Windmill Hill, it has three concentric circles, which is one more than most. So it's obviously a place of great interest. These concentric circles, according to archaeologists, are defensive. I can tell you that you couldn't defend anybody with a concentric circle. These concentric circles are there for two very good reasons, and we see this in Avebury at a later date. One is to actually somewhere for boats to moor, and the other one is to get water. We in medieval times spend time digging large wells. In the days of the Mesolithic people, and this was an advanced civilization, they had open plan water, and they'd done it for a very good reason, because within those concentric circles you plant reeds. And water companies now are realizing that reeds take toxins out of water and purifies it naturally. We've always used reeds throughout history for thatch roofs, and I believe for obviously boats within this period. So the concentric circles of Windmill Hill is fascinating because I think that was an island once upon a time. One of the amazing things where the second book will take over from the Stonehenge Enigma is actually show that there's actually a superhighway that goes from Avebury. If you follow the line of Avebury, and anybody has a map can follow it, you follow the Kennet down. But as you get towards Marlborough, it joins up with the Avon, and then goes towards Reading. And at that point, it joins the Thames. Now, at the time of the Mesolithic period, this was one giant waterway. And it would take people to a place called Doggerland. Now, Doggerland is a very important place in the Mesolithic. We know that there was a big culture there because, obviously, we've been finding their artifacts from under the sea for the last 100 years. But the interesting aspect, if these are seafaring, if this is a seafaring nation, if you wanted the quickest way to get to Doggerland, to the Mediterranean, would be via the Thames, via the Kennet, past Windmill Hill, and then out through the Bristol Channel. Now, what happened in, it seems, in Avebury, is that the original monument, which would be Windmill Hill, when the waters started to recede, looked a bit like Stonehenge, the boats would not be able to reach the summit. And as it dropped, what happened, another little island underneath opened up, which is now called Avebury, and that's slightly on higher ground. And it seems that at that point, probably at the same time when Stonehenge was having its big sarsen and stones being delivered at 4,500 BC, that Avebury too was being used, because that would then be the new port for that superhighway, because that river would still be flowing into the Bristol Channel. The fascinating thing with Avebury, that eventually even Avebury dried up, and then this is where Silbury Hill was built. Now, Silbury Hill is probably the last remnants of what would happen to the falling rivers of the Kennet, basically. And at that point, that was probably been the last port, and which was obviously the sanctuary, which still had its connections via the causeway to Avebury. So Avebury, in a sense, suffered from water loss much greater than Stonehenge, in that sense. But the effects were the same. The original monument changed over, and it's 4,000 years, which is a hell of a long time for societies. Over 4,000 years, the society changed, and Avebury, like Stonehenge, had to adapt slightly, and that's where you get these great megaliths from.
Now, Stonehenge, you've explained how this was a hospital, a place where people went in search of cure, and also a site of excarnation, where basically birds picked a body, a part of the dead, and then took it to heaven, according to a tradition, which was actually in place specifically at that period in time. So is Avebury the same purpose? Is there a difference? Do we know?
Oh, no. I would have been a meeting place. These are great traders. This civilization is a fantastic trading civilization. We've seen in the Mesolithic that we find jade polished stone axes. Now, the only way you get a jade polished stone axe is by a boat from the Mediterranean. No one's going to walk that, because remember, we're looking at jungle territory. You're not going to be able to get from Italy to Britain by any other means, by boat. So this is a maritime nation, and this is what Plato was saying in his writings. This was a great naval civilization. So the Stonehenge was a hospital, and you wouldn't need many, because I don't think the civilization was that huge number wise. You would only need one hospital. But what you do have at Avebury, and hence the size of it, this is a massive trading centre. This is where boats pulled up. This is, if anybody's lucky enough to have a boat on the Mediterranean, this is what you do at night. At night, you sail around on your boat all day, and at night you pull up into a port, and you have something to eat, and you tie up your boat, and you communicate, and you talk, and you exchange, and it's like a marketplace for these mariners. And you've got one in Avebury, and you've got a very similar one in Old Sarum as well. Again, it's two concentric circles in Old Sarum, and obviously you've got three up by Avebury. But they're very similar design, and they were both islands in the middle of these big oceans in the Mesolithic. And this is where the trading and talking, and this is where the culture basically thrived, because at the end of the day, the culture is spread by communication. And this civilization, they may not have written words, but they certainly had verbal communication, and they probably spent most of their time going from barbecue to barbecue, in a sense, telling stories and sharing experiences. So it was quite an interesting civilization, which unfortunately most archaeologists seem to try to lose with the idea of these so-called hunter-gatherers.
So basically you're saying, and I love this, to some extent, just the big A called Atlantis is a civilization of barbecue people, which I just love. But, but you've hinted at the Dogger Bank, which currently is underneath the North Sea.
Yeah.
You've hinted at Avebury and Stonehenge being connected to this Atlantis idea. Atlantis, obviously, Plato described it as roughly 10,000 years before his time. He also placed it outside of the Pillars of Hercules, which could be anywhere, but definitely could be Britain. What kind of other bits of evidence or understanding do you see that this is Atlantis?
Well, as I say, this is the first book of a trilogy. One of the things I was trying to do with the book is redate Stonehenge. It's vital that before I sort of went on to Atlantis and talk about Atlantis, we need to understand that some of these structures are far older and linked to a far more ancient civilization than we give credit to. Otherwise, the rest of the series wouldn't make sense. So that was the first book, basically redating Stonehenge and Avebury and those 70. So these are markers of a great maritime civilization. The dates of the fascinating thing to me is the dates, obviously, of Plato's Atlantis and Stonehenge's mooring posts are very, very similar. But there is other bits and pieces. The next book, Dawn and the Lost Civilization, which will be out in the autumn, we're now in a position and almost able to actually describe what the lantern looks like. We think we've got its DNA. We can actually tell you how tall it was, colour, skin, eyes, hair. It's quite frightening. One of the great interesting aspects of Stonehenge is that we believe we actually found a map of Atlantis in Stonehenge. Very clearly marked, giving the direction of where Atlantis is. And we believe we've got some nautical charts now to actually identify the exact location of Atlantis. So the next book will be quite sensational, as in we can actually look at who these people are, their blood type, their diet, their language. It's quite bewildering once you've got this scientific information now, especially with the new DNA processes, what you can piece together. It actually all makes quite the finest aspects, a little bit like Stonehenge, it actually makes sense. I'll give you a piece of information which, you know, one of the tools we found, just to give an illustration of how these people are what I would term advanced, is that the British are very proud of Agincourt and the longbow. And the longbow was like 16th century weapon of mass destruction for the British, which obviously conquered the French. Amazingly, we actually find a Mesolithic longbow, not necessarily in Britain, and this longbow actually can fire 100 metres, because they've rebuilt it, further than the English longbow. Not only that, the interesting aspect about this culture is that this longbow is actually fitted with a silencer. So when you fire, it doesn't make that twang noise. Now, it's clearly not a weapon for war, because you don't care how many twangs you make. This is a weapon of hunting, but it's of huge, huge sophistication. And the person that used it had to be of a certain physical physique to use it, because the pull strength, if any of your people know about archery, is about 245 pounds, which is huge. Just to give you an indication, with the English longbow people, they were slightly deformed because the longbow had to become almost part of their body to fire it. This longbow shoots 100 yards longer and needs a man about 30 kilos heavier to launch it, and that's all part of the second book. So it's the story will continue, and actually will get a lot more fascinating.
And it's a trilogy. So what are we expecting in part three?
Well, part three, I can't just leave it there, can I? Let's be honest. Part three will
no.
be what happened to them. Because everybody will ask the question, okay, you've told us where they are, you've showed us what they built, you've showed us what they, you know, what their technology is like. What the hell happened to them? And again, using the DNA, we can actually, and using and identifying the building techniques they used, we can see how, after something happened in Northern Europe, they sort of scattered throughout the world. And we will put place markers on the places they went, and how they're quite easily identifiable, which is quite interesting, and how they actually helped turn our society into an advanced civilization.
And I mean, that's it's you know, again, prehistoric Britain, the Stonehenge enigma. What I like about the book, first of all, it's very graphical. There are lots of photographs. You can visualize it very clearly. But it's also, you know, it's not a theory. It's you use the archaeological and geological evidence, and you actually show that when you look at the evidence the way it is, it's given its proper framework, and you basically guide the reader through it with basically 40 bits of proof of evidence to show that Stonehenge is far older than it is, and it's a remarkable book. You know what I think what impresses me most about this book is this: it's apart from the fact that it's beautifully published, it's something which is so obvious, and as you said at the very beginning of the show, if historians, if archaeologists had done their work, if even geologists had done their work correctly and had actually not taken certain things for granted and had been able to think outside the box, they would have arrived at these conclusions, and we would not have been in the quagmire of wrong understanding of so many things about our past. Robert, it's been a joy having you on. I will say that the book is called Prehistoric Britain, The Stonehenge Enigma. You can go to several places. Amazon.com and Amazon.co.uk is one place where you can get the book. You can go to www.prehistoric-britain.co.uk, as well as to www.the-stonehenge-enigma.co.uk. All of those three websites are going to be on our own website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. If you have enjoyed this show and you want to hear it again, you can go to the BBS Radio Archives. All the shows, more than a year and a half, almost 2 years of the Spirit Revolution, is archived there. You need to pay a small fee because you just do not get access to us, but to all other shows which are on the BBC Radio Network. You can, however, just go to thespiritrevolution.com, where you can get very easily the last 5 shows, the most recent ones, available for download or listening online. And if you master the technology, which is called iTunes, you can download a year and a half of Spirit Revolutions for free. But we have reached the end of this week's edition of The Spirit Revolution. We will be back next week. And as Kathleen normally says at this moment in time, the truth against the world.